Welcome to the Hemp Legally Speaking Podcast. I'm Jonathan Miller, your host. I also am the head of the Hemp Practice Group for Frost Brown Todd, the nation's leading firm when it comes to issues such as hemp and CBD. Not only do we advise clients on the whole panoply of issues in the space, ranging from litigation to corporate law to intellectual property, but we also serve as general counsel to the U.S. Hemp Roundtable and lead the industry's efforts to advocate for changes of laws and regulations that ultimately we advise our clients on. We are real pleased today to be joined by one of my Frost Brown Todd colleagues, Marty Rose. Marty is a longstanding class action defense lawyer, as well as an outstanding litigator. And Marty, you're joining us from your place in Denver right now?
Actually, in Southwest Colorado, up in the mountains.
Terrific. Yeah. Well, Colorado, like Kentucky, where I'm sitting, is the heart of hemp country, and we're pleased that you're able to join us for this. So, Marty, you've have a lot of experience in class action, not just simply in the hemp space, but we've seen in recent years a number of class action lawsuits being brought against hemp and CBD companies. It's calmed down a little bit, but it could pick up again fairly soon. But before we get into those, I think everyone is familiar with the concept of a class action, but probably isn't familiar with the details. Can you explain what is a class action lawsuit? Why are they brought, and what's the focus of these class action lawsuits?
Certainly, Jonathan, and hello all. The class action concept was originally a good idea, where a individual person had a minor injury. Let's say, for example, a utility company was rounding up their bills by a penny or a dime or a dollar, rather than the exact meter reading. An individual person who was being overcharged might be injured to the amount of pennies or a dollar in a year, and therefore there'd be no reason to bring a lawsuit. The idea that federal courts and states came up with was a way to represent that a group of people who individually didn't have a significant enough injury, but collectively had a very significant injury, and do it in a class action. So in essence, one plaintiff, one person, could sue an entity on behalf of an entire class of people nationwide, in some instances, for the same injury, and do it in a class, and therefore there was one lawsuit to be pursued rather than thousands of many minor lawsuits. That was the concept. Of course, with many things in the law, it has been adulterated and abused to the point where it's a major cost and risk factor for businesses that get wrapped up in them, because they can be expensive, time-consuming, and result in a lot of publicity, much of which is not publicity that a business would want to have.
So you've been involved in this. Can you kind of share your experience in the class action lawsuit defense space, what you do and kind of your typical clients?
Sure. I mean, as we have represented a number of folks in the CBD space, and we'll talk about that in a moment, but I've represented manufacturers and other entities in a broad variety of class action suits, primarily brought generally in California, Florida, or Texas. Illinois is a bit of a more minor jurisdiction. And they're brought there for a lot of reasons, but they're brought there primarily because those states have also passed state legislation that mirrors federal class action legislation and are very liberal laws that permit an individual plaintiff to pursue a claim on very little, if no, proof. There are law firms whose sole business model is pursuing these class action cases. And their real goal is money, of course. There is the occasional legitimate public wrong that a class action lawsuit will remedy, but most often it's about money. And these lawyers are looking for a quick dollar if they can get it, with the exception perhaps of the tobacco litigation, the recently settled opiate litigation. the more garden variety litigation that we've seen, for example, in the hemp space, the CBD space, is really a money grab by the law firms, to be candid.
Yeah, and let's just kind of dig in a little bit there, because, you know, you and I are both lawyers. We're proud to be part of the bar, and you mentioned there are some very successful but also morally upstanding plaintiff's lawyers who've brought these suits in areas such as smoking and opioids, and have done a great public service. But what's the financial incentive? Why are these trial lawyers suing hemp companies, for example? What kind of, can you explain the whole contingency fee and percentage, and do the average ordinary consumer actually get anything out of these lawsuits if they're won?
Great questions, and I concur with your comment about many of the lawyers being doing great job in meritorious cases. I, in fact, have represented a couple classes as a plaintiff in those situations. But the money grab is this, and again, I see that with a little bit of tongue in cheek. Plaintiffs work on a contingent fee basis. They get a recovery percentage, generally, depending on the case, anywhere from 20 to 40% of a recovery. So, of course, they don't want to do work if there's not going to be a recovery, and they want to make certain that the work they do is commensurate with the recovery they can obtain. So in a class, they look at an individual product, say a CBD tincture, and say, okay, that cost $25 to buy. It was marketed improperly and illegally. So if I've got a single plaintiff who bought a tincture, and in fact it was misrepresented or it was adulterated, that's $25, not worth filing a lawsuit. If instead I can get a class certified of 10,000 consumers of that same tincture, now I, as a lawyer, have a worthwhile lawsuit that potentially produces a very good payday for me and my fellow partners. Now, what the trick here is that class action lawsuits are really two lawsuits. There's what we call the lawsuit within the lawsuit. The most important part of the case is to get what's called class certification, to go through a myriad of rules and prove to the judge that you, in fact, your plaintiffs can represent an identical class of persons in either the state or nationally or in a number of states who had the exact identical injury. That can be a lawsuit in of itself, which can take 2 years to get through and require a lot of discovery and motion practice. But the trick for the defendant is this: if in fact it cannot be certified as a class and you successfully defeat that certification, then the lawsuit goes away because you're representing one person and that person damages are not worth pursuing. And so some lawyers who are defending companies tend to take a sort of a laissez-faire approach and attack the whole lawsuit and discover it all at once and hope they win at the certification hearing. We find a better approach to be to attack the pleading and try to convince the court that they should not even begin the process of examining whether or not there is a class that can potentially be certified for this alleged injury. And so that's the game. And perhaps, if I might, Jonathan, let's talk about the CBD space and
yeah,
the experience we've had.
Yeah, let's take the magnifying glass onto hemp and CBD. And so what are these, what class action lawsuits have been brought in the hemp CBD space, and particularly which ones were you intimately involved in?
We're involved in nearly all of them, have been to date. And many will recall in this space that in November of 2019, the FDA sent warning letters to a number of CBD manufacturers saying, you know, you're saying that your product's a dietary supplement or it's good for dog food supplements, and we haven't tested your product. We don't know that it is or not. And therefore, we're warning you not to make these representations. The plaintiff's trial bar in class action space saw this as a tremendous opportunity. Literally within weeks of that letter coming out, a number of our clients were sued in California, in Florida, in one potential suit in Illinois. And the theories were basically this. You're claiming your tincture, for example, is a dietary supplement, or it is good for pet supplements or has other medical benefits, or that it is a quote pure tincture of CBD when in fact it is not. And therefore you are violating the law and you're misrepresenting your product, and the damages are I bought your product and I thought it was a safe FDA approved product and it was not. The problem with all these theories was simple. The Farm Bill said hemp is legal and hence CBD is legal, but the FDA had not issued any rulemaking or had done any testing to determine what, if any, strictures it would place on the use of CBD as a supplement or in any other variety of ways it's been marketed. So the typical allegations in all these lawsuits were that sale of CBD was illegal under the current regulations because there were no regulations, and that CBD products labeled as dietary supplements were mislabeled or inaccurate, that there were not inadequate directions for use, and they were advertised to have medical benefits or benefits for pets and animals, that kind of thing. Those are the allegations, and the choice we faced was pretty stark. We could simply attack on the class certification front and hope for the best, or we could attack the very gravamen of the lawsuit. And we looked at it and discussing it internally with a great deal of guidance from Jonathan, realized that all the Farm Bill accomplished was to say that hemp and CBD were legal. And therefore, in the absence of regulating by the FDA how it's to be used or sold or marketed, that any kind of a lawsuit claiming it was illegal as a dietary supplement was premature. We had tremendous success with that approach, while some of our other law firms who were involved and took a different approach had less success. If I might, I'll maybe give one or two examples, Jonathan,
let me just come in a second. And for our listeners who've been listening to this podcast regularly, if you haven't, please hit the subscribe button. We'd love to have you join us more often. But, the focus, it seems every week we talk about the FDA and the fact that the FDA has not yet developed a regulatory pathway for CBD. This is the underlying what Marty's talking about. It underlines our problems with intellectual property, with banking, and so on. And so it's this common theme is running through this whole process. So Marty, please continue.
No, good point. And please jump in anytime, Jonathan, with any current developments that I'm certain I'm not fully aware of. But we had cases filed in California, and not just filed in California. These were by a series of cases were filed by a Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, nationally recognized class action plaintiffs law firm. So again, these are serious lawyers with highly qualified skills, and that can work to your favor, and of course, going to be against you. But in these cases, they actually took great pains to find a plaintiff in the Northern District of California, and specifically in the San Jose Division of the Federal District Court, because there's a federal judge there who's well known for her work in the Silicon Valley, and plaintiff's lawyers believe that she would A, is very sharp, B, has done class action work, and is very experienced at it, and C, they felt that would be a favorable jurisdiction from a standpoint of a jury should it get that far. So lawsuits were filed, two were filed against CBD manufacturers. And at the same time, that same law firm filed a case in the Southern District of California against another CBD manufacturer based down there. And they took the opposite approach. They looked at it and really focused on class certification issue. We focused very much on the adequacy of the pleading and, in fact, whether or not there could be a cause of action stated. Assuming there was a certifiable class, could this class actually pursue a claim against our clients based upon these allegations of a lack of FDA approval? Our first motion, we like to think, was so well written that the plaintiff dismissed and voluntarily refiled the lawsuit trying to clean up the pleadings. We didn't believe they had done that, and we attacked it again. And in the short course of about, I would say it was from filing to dismissal, about 5 months, the plaintiff's firm gave up and dismissed their lawsuits against our clients and have not refiled them. Now, the lawsuit they filed against the other CBD manufacturer continued on. And I confess I've not checked recently, Jonathan, on the status of that lawsuit. But those are quick examples in California, which is where they, again, tend to typically first be filed.
Now, do you see that these lawsuits will be brought back when the FDA finally issues regulations?
Well, that is the Sears question that I don't have an answer for. I would suspect yes. What is lacking and what we've proven was lacking was any kind of a regulatory framework by which a manufacturer of CBD had to judge and market their products to avoid running afoul of the law. When a regulatory agency like the FDA does regulate, they can sometimes do it prospectively. In other words, it would affect only product manufactured and marketed and sold after the date of regulation, or retroactively and dated backdated. So whether the FDA regulates it and does it prospectively or retroactively will affect these lawsuits. But my guess is that there will be lawsuits filed once the FDA has acted, because it's such a hot market, and the plaintiffs' lawyers see a lot of manufacturers making some fairly significant claims of benefits without a lot of research or certainly demonstrated efficacy. And so I think we will see these lawsuits again.
So do you think that the lawsuits that will be in the future will be focused on the true illegal activity, which is making claims of medical benefits, or do you think that we will see more of the same lawsuits that are just on the idea of selling products as dietary supplements?
You know, again, depending on what the FDA does, I think we will see both. For example, there is a lawsuit pending against one of our clients in California. It's a California class action, but it alleges a separate injury, and that's why the lawsuit is actually still pending. In this case, a user claimed that they failed an employer's drug test for marijuana, and yet they only used a CBD tincture, and therefore they were damaged because there were inaccurate representations on the label or marketing about whether or not there were any trace elements of THC, or indeed whether or not a drug test would still be a risk for a CBD user. So that's an example of where there's a bit of a unique allegation. And that's just for, yeah.
Yes. So we got a lot of CBD manufacturers that are listening to this podcast right now. What do you recommend that they do now to take themselves out of the crosshairs of any future class action lawsuits, or is that impossible?
Well, I don't know that it's. I don't know that it's impossible. I will tell you, it's always a set of odds, and it depends on the lawyer who's looking at the case and whether there is a dedicated activist as a plaintiff, because most often these lawyers have a Rolodex, if you will, of people they can call who are willing to be plaintiffs. Oftentimes there's friends of employees in a law firm or what have you. So the way to avoid the crosshairs is to be reasonable and smart and ethical. Don't make wild claims for your product that you can't prove. Don't tell folks that they can do things that you haven't demonstrated through rigorous scientific study and peer-reviewed results that they can do. CBD is extremely marketable and popular product right now, and I think the smart manufacturers are being very careful in what they say about what their product can and can't do, and be accurate about what's in it. If you haven't got, you know, do your testing, make certain you know that your product is pure or doesn't have adulterated compounds like lead, for example, that would already violate an existing FDA regulation, even though it may not specifically yet apply to CBD, you can be certain that it will in the future. So that'd be my general advice.
Yeah. And much of that issue about labeling, we discussed on an earlier podcast with Kimra Hall. If you haven't checked that out, do that. She goes through many of the guidelines in terms of what you can say and you can't say on a label. And she talks about it in the context of FDA warning letter might come your way. But what Marty talks about is a lot more expensive, is if you do this, you could make yourself vulnerable to a class action lawsuit. So Marty, thank you so much for joining us. And if folks want to get in touch with Marty, either proactively or if on the unfortunate case you are the defendant in such a lawsuit, his email address is mrose@fbtlaw.com, while mine continues to be jmiller@fbtlaw.com. And want to thank you for listening in to the Hemp Legally Speaking podcast, Frost Brown Todd's Hemp Practice Group's efforts to keep you in touch with all the evolving laws and regulations of the hemp and CBD space. And lastly, Marty, thank you for joining us and providing your expertise.
Well, Jonathan, thanks for having me. And I hope that we provide some helpful advice. You all have a great day.
All right. Thank you.